Good morning and welcome to this edition of the show here on WNHH 103.5 FMLP. We stream, baby, all day long. Welcoming back my producer, Harry, who has been MIA. I'm not going to ask any questions, but I'm glad to see him again. And today's conversation is built around the silent protest parade and rally, which is going to take place this coming Saturday, July 29th, starting off at the address of the Dixwell Q House, beginning at 11 a.m. sharp. They are going to step off. And this march is sponsored by the Greater New Haven branch of the NAACP. And in the studio with me today is one of the participants, Dr. David Canton. Dr. David Canton is an associate professor of history and director of the Africana Studies Program at Connecticut College and the author of Raymond Pace Alexander, A New Negro Lawyer Fights for Civil Rights in Philadelphia. He is a Public Voices Fellow through the Opt-Ed Project. And we also welcome his daughter, Moncho, to the show. So thank you both for sitting in the studio today.
Thank you for inviting us.
So let's talk about this. Why is it important now? Not only is this, I believe, an acknowledgement of the march that took place 100 years ago, correct?
Correct.
But it's also felt to be something that needs to happen because of not only the violence against African Americans, but is it focusing on the violence that is going on in our communities as well as outside of our communities?
That's a great question. I think it's two things we're celebrating. Number one, it's the 100th anniversary of the Greater New Haven chapter of NAACP.
Okay.
Which was founded July 20th, 1917. Then 8 days later, you have the silent protest parade by the NAACP in New York. And that protest parade was protesting against lynchings, racial violence, also about Jim Crow laws. So doing the march, celebrating the local chapter's 100th anniversary, but at the same time, we have a long history, a century, 100 years to see that in spite of electing a black president, in spite of all the gains, we still see systemic inequality African-Americans encounter. We also see that these also impact larger other communities.
Mm-hmm.
We all know livable wages. We know income inequality, educational equity, one of these issues we're still fighting for, that we know that in city schools they're underfunded. So these are long-term systemic issues. So I think with this silent protest parade, we're showing that, yes, there's been progress, but we're concentrating on steps we have to go further on these issues. Second chance programs. We know with the high levels of mass incarcerations, even though crime rates are down, when people come out and there's no jobs with livable wages, we see that's a problem. So these are some of the local issues. Now, in terms of internal issues with crime and violence that you ask, obviously we know crime is intra-racial. Whites kill whites, blacks kill blacks, Asians kill Asians, and that's a major issue as well, which may come up with one of the rally speakers, but I think at the same time we can do two things at once. Oftentimes people argue, one has to be before the other. You can't talk about police violence unless African-Americans, quote-unquote, clean up their neighborhood. What I've noticed that I don't see any other community making those type of arguments. Before I do A, I have to do B. I don't see that anywhere else.
Uh-huh.
So again, you could do both at the same time, but this is going to focus on that the systemic issues that we're encountering, and that recognizing that 100 years ago, 8,000 to 10,000 people came out to protest, and that we still need to continue to protest, continue to marching in spite of people's, some people have cynicism, what are you marching for, but a way to raise consciousness, get people fired up and ready to start working. I'll give you August off when September comes in to get organized and start working to make it improve in the community.
Now, 100 years ago, the issue was one of lynching.
Correct.
Because for a time period, and you can probably give me from when to when, at least 4,000 people of color in this country were lynched.
Correct.
And this was a way to say, we're outraged. We're not tolerating this. Something has to be done.
Correct. We see lynching as a reaction to, remember, when you have Africans migrating to the North, migrating after World War I, after slavery, when African Americans now have access, We see that many whites got upset. Blacks were used as strike breakers because it's cheaper wages. So instead of the white working class working with black laborers, they decided to join up with white capitalists. And oftentimes those riots were started that way. We also see during those riots, in those periods, they would go after middle class African Americans.
Because there were so many affluent black Wall Streets, if you will.
Correct.
The one probably best known is the one in Tulsa.
Correct, 1921.
And Wilmington, North Carolina as well.
1898, you have Atlanta, 1906, Springfield, Illinois, 1908. And you always see a common thread, you know, that you have middle class African American successful blacks, quote unquote uppity Negroes, would be the first to attack their property burnt down. And a friend of mine done a study saying that many black elite blacks realize that you need to be politically active, because no matter how much money you have, that doesn't stop a mob. But by voting and engaging politically, you have a better opportunity to one way to defend yourself.
As LeBron James recently found out.
Correct.
With the scrawling of the N-word on the house that he was staying in California.
Correct. Doesn't matter how much money you make, right? These are race is still real. And that you're not, no matter the wealth you have, you're still not protected.
Well, you start off your recent article for LARB blog, an essay, "A Century Later, Protest March for the Rights of Black Americans is More Necessary Than Ever." The noose is making a comeback. And so it's kind of a cyclical piece, if you will, because it shows that recently, in this 100-year period, we're seeing more and more nooses appear. And 100 years ago, again, this march was held to call for an end to lynchings. So where are we?
Great question. Obviously, we see after Obama came out of the office, President Trump is direct reaction to President Obama. And we see this long history when African Americans take a step forward, white people want to put them two steps back. So obviously we see with the rise of President Trump, the rise of the right, or this quote unquote white populism, that now we dig into the history memory bank, and what symbol but the noose coming out. People might even think it's free speech. I have a right to do that. They found two in the National African American Museum because people know the power of symbols. That's why you always see people, don't let the flag hit the ground. Don't burn the flag. Symbols are powerful. Mm-hmm. And the noose is one of the most powerful symbols. Now, we're going to find people on trees in New Haven and New York. Most likely not. But that symbol still means something to many people. It has a definite connotation.
Well, it has power.
Without a doubt.
It has history.
Yes.
So with that, you know, it's an image that's not easily forgotten.
Correct. And the people that put out there, they know that. So again, 100 years later, they reach for one of the most powerful symbols in this nation's history. And that's why this protest parade is important, to let people know that there's still a long way to go. And that even though you have a black president, it's almost like having a black president put things in reverse. But that's just this long history of this country.
Well, let's sidebar about that for a minute. Because a lot of people are saying what we're experiencing now is people who held their tongues, if you will, the whole time that Obama was in office. So now people are beginning to feel free to express the racism, the sexism, ageism, because we're existing in a backlash environment.
Great question. So we see these groups, African Americans, women, Latinos, post 65. So for many Americans, are the silent majority, white working class whites. Argument now is President Trump has allowed this community that allegedly have been silent, but they still have privilege, are now coming out, whether it's in the universities, in these news things coming. We have the space, Fox News, the platform to get rid of quote unquote political correctness and bring this stuff out that the civil rights movement said, at least in popular culture, maybe in your home, but in public mainstream space, we know what it is. Let's stop pretending that now we can put down PC, because in the universities, these left-leaning professors told me as a conservative, I can't say these things, but now I'm letting out with a fury. And that the Justice Department, universities, right wing, Fox News, we have this space now. We've been holding it for 40 years. Now it's time to unleash this discourse on all different levels, from a microaggression level to the noose level. Mm-hmm. And we see even on many occasions on Facebook with violence. That's why, again, this protest parade, again, reminiscing what happened in the past and how we still need to go forward and why still people need to engage and get involved.
So when we talk about this march, why this march? Mm-hmm. And why now?
Why now? So like I said earlier, the number one, as a historian, I think it's important to recognize, right, that, again, 100 years ago, this Friday, 8 to 10,000 African Americans marched in Manhattan to protest racial lynching. 100 years today, the silent protest parade, quickly looking at local issues, second chance programs, educational equity, as a way to build consciousness, but also as a way to get people, like I said, informed and have an agenda. What can we do this upcoming year? We know usually organizations start September. We go right back to school. What parents can do to get engaged? Elected officials, we don't have to wait the last minute till 2018 to start voting. Let's start thinking about these issues. So let's use this march as a springboard. Again, I'll give you August off. When September comes around, you know, for example, if you're in an organization, you went to 4 meetings, go to 8 meetings. If you went to 8 meetings, run for office. There's something everyone can do, as my colleague Joe Mattis, friend Joe Madison says, the Black Eagle. We all can do something. So we want to use this as a way to create folks to get involved. At the same time, let the city know in terms of educational equity, you know, in terms of second chance programs, how to get engaged. So when you leave that, you'll have some sort of marching orders, something that one can do, and that
you have a charge.
Have a charge. And also we'll follow up during the year, making those phone calls to elected officials, local organizations, and that's the way to ensure that progress moves ahead.
So the focus of this march, once we get to the green,
correct,
what will be discussed? What is the platform right for that afternoon?
Right. So we have speakers. So right now we have Robin Porter, local official, Kalila Brown from Quinnipiac University, myself, Chief Police Campbell will come in, talk about police community relations. So obviously we know that there's national issues, but obviously we're going to concentrate on local
issues. On local issues.
Right. So like educational equity, right? Police community relations, what specific policies or programs, and how can folks community get engaged to ensure that what occurs in these other cities don't happen in New Haven? In terms of voter registration, voter suppression, obviously we know Connecticut's not Texas, but there are ways people from Connecticut can engage in those states. When there are local elections, you can make a phone call. If you have the resource, you can donate $5 to a close race in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And then also Robin Porter, what's going on in Hartford? Mm-hmm. A lot of times we think folks going up there just having lunch and relax. They're out there battling.
Right.
But we don't know.
Right.
You don't see it every day unless it's something really extreme. So she will come out. Maybe there's two or three issues she can put on the table. This is why you need to vote. And what can you do to get behind that? So real pragmatic, you know, things you can catch on to, and that's something you can, what you want to engage in, what you're interested in, and get engaged. And that's the nature of this. So you leave here with something to do, and it's not just the march for march's sake, mm-hmm. something where march with marching orders, and what particular area are you interested in? Education, politics, the police community relations, there's probably all type of committees you can join. That's what this is all about.
And this march is not necessarily for African Americans.
So like Dr. King said, 15% of the population can't change 85%, right? So the reality is you need a white people to vote for President Obama, right? So you do need allies. But again, when you build coalitions, we learn from history, mm-hmm. right? We talk about allies. What is an ally? So obviously we want all people to show up, but we engage these issues and don't expect African Americans to put the race card off the table. A real ally will engage that issue. But we all want health care. Who doesn't want good schools? Who doesn't want a livable wage? Who doesn't want health care? Those bread and butter issues, regardless of Christian, Muslim, atheist, is what people want. Those are the bonding issues.
So define what an ally is.
I think an ally is an individual. A, they recognize their privilege in the conversation. They recognize that they don't have those answers for the group, right? They also recognize it's their role to also go out into their own communities and try to get people to be allies like themselves, which I think is more difficult mm-hmm. than going into that group, mm-hmm. right? Who wants to be the person to come home at the dinner table and be that one? Oh, there goes so-and-so again. It's easier. You see that historically, go to that a grief community, wow, there's somebody that don't look like us who wants to join. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So we want allies to get out and engage in their own communities. Maybe in September, if you can get one friend, one family member thinking differently about these issues, that's a step.
So I know you've given in this particular essay different examples of the different things that have gone on around the country in regard to racism. Mm-hmm. And I know the answer, but I think my question would be, why are we suddenly exposed to or hearing more and more about particular instances? Is it because people are shocked? Is it because of media? We have so much that we can pick up just from looking at our phone. Or is it the fact that these incidents are increasing because, again, we've got a backlash from Obama? Or is it a combination of things?
It's a combination. Obviously, we know the social media. So 30 years ago, before cable, if someone got beat up in L.A., you found out maybe 3 days later. 24-hour news, you found out that evening. Social media, you find out in a second. But we also got to look at the economy. This is, I think, what people miss. Let's go back 100 years. African Americans migrate to the North. Capitalists said, listen, let's hire these blacks as strike breakers because what, we pay them less. 2017, we know in our post-industrial economy and automation, it's a race to the bottom, as my friend Joe Madison says, the cheaper wages. So now we have many Americans who now don't have livable wage jobs. And I need something to blame. But you're blaming African Americans. You really should be blaming automation and capitalism. So all that frustration has to go somewhere. So I go to social media, I watch TV, I see a black president. In my mind, African Americans are three feet out front because of affirmative action, even though white women were the number one beneficiaries.
Mm-hmm.
So what do I do with this anger?
Right.
Do I look within myself, my own community? No. I look at Muslims, immigrants, African Americans. I don't look at Facebook, the owners of GM, right? Coal miners. Coal miners are losing jobs to automation.
Right.
You don't take coal mines and move them to China. You bring in machines. But they continue to buy that argument. So who I get mad at? The black president. So this economic piece and globalization is very important. And many people miss the boat on that. They don't understand the combination of racism and capitalism. They work hand and also
they work
sexism.
Hand in hand.
They work hand in hand. So we know why we have quote unquote IT jobs. We can't find anybody. No, you pay someone less wages than a graduate from Caltech.
Right.
But we'll sell the value argument. They're just better workers. You can't. No, they're not. It's just cheap wages. So we have to have a better understanding of that. And I think most people do. But then what do you do with it?
Right. And that was my question. What do you do with it? Because you have people who actually believe that those coal mining jobs are coming back and that, you know, they're going to go down in a mine like their father and their grandfather and their great grandfather and their great great grandfather. Mm-hmm. And they're going to have their jobs back and they're going to have a livable wage doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in some ways, America has not fully wrapped itself around the 21st century and what that means.
Right.
And so consequently, you have folks who actually believe that the way we did things 20 years ago is still feasible. And so we come up with what we have mm-hmm. because people are frustrated.
Right. I mean, can I give you an example?
Yes.
Last week, my landline, I still have a landline, wasn't working. I called Comcast. I believe it was a call center.
Mm-hmm.
So through the phone, they fixed it. Remember those guys that came to your house?
Right.
They had the big belt,
right.
All that stuff. They parked the truck, spent about 2 hours, cost you a grip to fix your jack. That's when you realize automation, technology, easy pass, all those bridge jobs are gone.
Yeah.
So this is why when you get into these marches, you meet people, have conversations. You take it back into these organizations, but you're so busy working and surviving.
Yes.
Then you're frustrated, right? You're watching TV. This information is being passed and it's being internalized over and over again. So you need to get in a space where you have a different perspective. So that's what I'm saying. These marches aren't just a waste of time. It's where you get the issues. Let me come to these meetings and have a different perspective, getting educated, right? And you hear these conversations, then you say, you know what? I never thought of it. Mm-hmm. That's important. So mm-hmm. now when you go back, you know what? I heard some automation. The what's that in the supermarket?
The self-checkout.
Self-checkout. So instead of 7 cashiers, I got one person running 8 of those machines.
Yeah.
That's automation. It's not that folks don't want to work. It's because it's cheaper wages due to automation. They don't want vacations. They have no attitude. They don't want overtime.
Right.
It makes our life easier. No pensions. Makes our life easier. I mean, out the store, you know, you still have to wait when things mess up.
You still need a human
right.
being.
You still need someone, right? So we want to, so hopefully after this protest parade, these issues become more central to our understanding of global, this is happening all over the world.
Yeah.
We see in Europe with now the increase of immigrants to do cheap labor. So now their social systems, who should get free health care?
Yeah.
And we see that here.
It's a big thing.
Right, with health care here. So the argument by many whites, black people are getting free stuff, but we know numerically more poor whites are benefiting from ACA than African-Americans.
Yes.
When we watch TV, we hear rumors about black people don't want to work. You get angry. You're yelling at the wrong person. And for many African-Americans, again, we have to get engaged with ourselves on these issues. Whether we're anti-racist or there's some maternal issues, how we treat with LGBTQIA communities.
Yes.
Those issues.
Because I'm sure you've heard that the president has pulled the transgender ban out.
Yep.
And so as of today, transgender people will no longer be able to serve in the military.
And that's playing to your base, right?
Yes.
So he knows. So after I get hit in the face with the rut, I go to the base. I double down.
I just keep
with the
going
base.
To my base.
That's it. I double down on the base. You know, so that's the strategy. But I'm just, again, going back to this march, that on this level, there's so much people can do. I think, yes, we're all frustrated. I don't have all the answers. Everybody's frustrated. But definitely as a historian reading this long history of African-American activism, that's what it takes. When African-Americans, when people organize, government responds. When you don't organize, you get frustrated, nothing happens. Now, when I was younger, I didn't believe that. As I get older, it's starting to make more sense.
Yeah, because I was going to say two things. I think what it is in this time period is that we need to dialogue. That's the only thing I think right now that gives you a true sense of what people are going through. Mm-hmm. Because I, for a long time, you know, as a young person, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was a supremacist. I believe totally in black everything. Blackity black black, right? But as you get older and you have more experience with people and you learn your own history as well as the history of the country you live in, then you get to understand how things work, how things function. And unfortunately or fortunately in America, because there are so many different types of people, we don't work well unless we work together. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily have to love me, but you have to understand that if things are not well for me, they're not going to be well for you either.
Right.
In some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. So I'm really beginning to believe that part of the arc that we need to see bend is toward conversation, is toward real dialogue. I am believing that we probably need to do something like South Africa did, truth and reconciliation, in the respect that we don't talk about race in this country. Race is a very touchy subject. It's ugly. Nobody really wants to have the conversation because they feel it's so personal. Well, yes, it is. But at the same time, it's one of the greatest issues besides economics in this country.
Right.
And we have not sat down and said, you know what? something's got to change. You need to either stand beside me or get out of the way so that this change can happen.
I mean, those are excellent points. I just think, let's look at our K-12 system, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're so focused on the standardized test,
mm-hmm.
focused on this content of this information you're supposed to know. The real value is in knowing yourself and knowing others. So we know in our curriculums, because we don't have African history, Latino history as the center. Once you know yourself, then you know other people.
Correct.
Unfortunately, marginalized groups are trained the other way. First, let me learn about Western Civ. Then I find out about myself, realize my culture isn't as quote unquote good as this culture. So that needs to be changed. And I also think as you get older, right? So I think I started on that plane, right? Race.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got married. Wow, I'm really sexist. Wow. Right? Then I got a PhD. Wow. Class is real. Right? I want my kids to grow up in the Bronx. Nah, forget it. They're
right.
Suburban kids.
Right.
But it's through those experiences. That's key. And at the same time, if you want to have these conversations, racism is not just black to black people talking, it's white people.
It's that's sexism. What I mean. It's dialogue.
Men talking about men about sexism.
Right.
And not just, oh, I don't hit my woman. Well, thank you.
Right.
It's about a conversation. Rich people talking to wealthy people. Quote, these conversations. So there's no platform. Look at how America's set up with hyper segregation
mm-hmm.
in our schools, places of worship. Where is that space? Not even in universities, we have silos.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the space? I have four jobs. All this talk. I need some action. I don't want to wait.
Right.
There's no space set up. You have to create the space. So it's, again, these marches start. What are you going to do after?
Right.
Join an organization. And having these conversations are so valuable. Wow, I never thought of that. Because you have these weekly conversations with people not in your circle group.
Right.
That you open up.
And that's the, and I think that's the other piece when you start to talk about dialogue in these type of situations, you have to come into this with an open mind, because there's going to be things that are said that you're not going to like, but it is how somebody's feeling. And in order for you to take in or to have an exchange in communication, you have to be just as open minded, and that person has to be receptive to what you're talking about, because they are not going to be comfortable with what you're saying as a person of color in this country.
Well, let me throw it at this, how it gets frustrating sometimes. Bill O'Reilly,
mm-hmm.
he went to Sylvia's with Reverend Al Sharpton. This was like 10 years ago. And he said, this is Riley said, I am surprised there was no cursing. Folks weren't loud. It was clean. And he got berated. In fact, Fox News called me to get on the show to comment. But of course, I was bumped by Jesse Jackson. We didn't talk in that show for 8 years. But my point is, O'Reilly comes on the next day and says, you see, we can have a dialogue. He's saying people should be allowed to say, black people are loud. I should be allowed to say these racial stereotypes. I sit there and take it calmly.
Mm-hmm.
And one can argue, okay, it's 2017. There's thousands of books.
Right.
And that becomes a challenge. So it's asking African Americans to sit down and let people say that. You're like, okay, wait a minute. I know all white people aren't X. I know all white people aren't Y. And I think that becomes frustrating in that, yes, I should be open, but there should be a level of information.
Yes.
Before we get in there, a level of information where I'm not coming in from level A, Z.
Right.
Black people are lazy. You know, Dave, well, you're different. No, stop. Black people don't want to work. You know you're allowed. Okay. And that's the problem. So in other words, if I can't say that, free speech, you know, if I can't say that, call me when I can say that. Mm-hmm. I have a problem with that. That's it's asking me to be open, to be yes, but at the same time, it's not requiring them. Go read a book. Go take some time and really, and then come, let's really talk. You see what I'm saying? And that's what O'Reilly's statement said. And I think that's for some white Americans, I'm a good, quote unquote, good person. But starting from that premise, I should be able to say that those racist stereotypes.
Yeah.
It gets problematic. It's 2017.
It's 2017. But I think, you know, when you start to talk that way, unfortunately, that's going to come out. That's part of the conversation on both sides of the room. I mean, I went to an NPR piece where they talked about Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the people in the room started saying, well, I have constituents. He was a state rep. And he was like, I had constituents who feel that, you know, their kid couldn't get into Yale because, you know, you got spaces for Latinos and you got spaces for people, you know. Mm-hmm. And somebody who was Latino and a Yale undergraduate, you know, got their BA from Yale, was like, hold up. I work very hard to get into Yale and stay in Yale and right. not leave and get my degree. So if your constituent's child didn't get in, perhaps they need to look at her grade point average. Because I worked very hard. You know, and people in the room were upset with the statement that the Caucasian gentleman made. But that's how people are feeling. Mm. And until you have these dialogues, I mean, was I comfortable with his statement? Absolutely not. But I really tried to listen to it from a standpoint of, this is how he feels. And it takes, trust me when I tell you, it takes a lot to sit there and listen to it. But you have to be in the frame of mind where you're saying, where are we as a country? You know, and I'm sure you don't want your daughter to grow up with the same stuff. You know, as a journalist, you're never supposed to talk about yourself. Right. Okay. But I will say this. I have protested. I have marched. I have sat in. I have sat out. I have carried signs. I have slept places. I have registered people to vote. I've done it all, right? And in my lifetime, in my span, it has not changed. It changed for a megasecond. And now we're almost back to where I was when I started in high school. You know, the riots, the racism, the name calling, the nooses. We're almost back to that. And so my thing is, I don't see any other way to do this other than say to you, somebody who's not of color, look, you need to come to something like this so you can really hear what's on people's minds and have an open mind and present your opinion in a forum where people might say to you, okay, I'm willing to listen. I don't know if I'm going to agree, mm-hmm. but I'm at least willing to listen. You know, because so many times I think right now, especially over the past 10, 15 years, we've been yelling at each other, right. You know, and nobody's willing to sit down and say, you know what? I don't like your opinion, but I'm willing to listen to it so we can try to make some progress because mm-hmm. it's about progress. And I don't consider myself a liberal. I don't consider myself conservative. But I think I've sort of in some ways had a change of heart about a couple of things, just about this much. Because when I go to other parts of the world, I'm an American. They don't see me as African or, you know, oh, you're mixed with African and, you know, Caucasian and Indian. I'm an American. And, you know, I had to even take it from the standpoint of my uncles, my dad, my relatives all were in the armed forces. That's what helped them get a start in life. So for you to even sit up and say something to me about how African Americans don't care about this country is absurd. Absurd. I don't see it. You know, and the older I get, the more that kind of changes for me. Because like I said, when I was young, it was power to the people. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hear it. Mm-hmm. We're going to do this. We're going to burn stuff down. And I was in those spaces. And as time has gone on, even though I think that I've grown, I think we're almost back to where we were. And so things like this, while they are necessary, more people need to be included in that circle. And it's not that we're African Americans as a whole are not willing to accept people in their circle. They have been because there were certain things in the civil rights movement we could not get done unless other people who were not of color were participatory. Right. And it may not be your favorite phrase, but that's just the way it was. And so now I think we need to go back to that because we have to understand that the way things are now, we're never going to come together. It's always going to be a bigger divide if we can't at least sit down and see each other for who we are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think, well, I think it's two things. I think we say, I like using statistics in my class. You know, mm-hmm. people would say, well, it was better in 1950. There's all types of data that goes against that.
Because it wasn't better.
It's so difficult because you have this memory, and this history.
Right.
So memory
exactly.
says every black person went to church in 1950. No, they didn't.
No, they didn't.
In all black schools, no one got in trouble. Yes,
no, they
did. Right. So we know statistically more blacks graduate from college now than ever.
Mm-hmm.
We know there's data to show all that. Right. But at the same time, right, when you watch TV, when you see these individual acts, so the systemic racism of institutions, and then the stuff you see on Snapchat, on Facebook, the individual.
Yeah.
Then you start thinking it's getting worse. When statistically, black people live longer, the poverty rate is lower than 1960. So I know that. Why? Because of the civil rights movement, folks have access to opportunity.
Right.
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 Even though there's hip hop, right? Statistically, the hip hop generation, as educationally, income, and all that. Not saying there's no problems with hip hop,
right?
But even though you had soul music in the 60s, there's more poor black folks.
Right.
So it's the system. So I think, like I said, when you have these conversations, the challenge is that, like I said before, the way our system's structured with the hyper-segregation, our K-12 system is totally, they do not do a good job. It's just, they might be individual teachers, but because of the pressure of the standardized tests,
right.
that's a major problem. So this conversation is not as important as knowing, you know, the ancient Greeks, right?
Right.
This conversation is not as important. You must know George Washington's birthday.
Right.
This is not as important. So it isn't until many when they get to college. But 1,000 kids don't go to college.
Right.
So we have this conversation.
Right.
Right. So when you live in Philadelphia, there's North Philly, South, you go to Boston.
Right.
Rigid segregation. You will never see a white or black in your whole life to have these conversations. That's the challenge we have.
Yep.
And I think the reality is, as a racist capitalist state, you know, it's good for business, unfortunately. Right. It keeps things going because the reality in this nation's history, when you have African-Americans and whites together progressively, there's a lot of change.
Mm-hmm.
You look at your 30s and 40s with labor and civil rights working together.
Correct.
Right, but then it got split during the Cold War.
Right.
That's the most threatening thing.
Well, I've discovered that African-Americans were in deep support of Grover Cleveland, which I never knew, never found that out. I just happened to be watching something one night on Grover Cleveland. And they talked about how he not only supported African Americans, but the fact that he supported them joining the labor unions and, you know, doing all these other things, which we don't think about until FDR. But in reality, he was a proponent of civil rights back in the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
So, but of course, they poisoned him, he died. You know,
well, keep in mind, you have to look at it this way. People talk about Booker T. Washington. The reality,
yes.
black elites could always vote. They
yes.
qualified.
Yes.
So in many cities, they were to balance a power vote
mm-hmm.
between both parties. So you were playing softball, whichever's going to get me what. So in the 1880s, after Reconstruction,
mm-hmm.
it was like, pick a team. So for either part, what do I need to do to win? So I'm going to contact the blacks who can vote. What do you 50, 100 people want, need?
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, I can take these positions. But we also got to remember when Booker T. Washington went to the White House in 1901 to visit Theodore Roosevelt, white folks went crazy.
Right.
But Booker T. had all his hands in any black Republican function. That's politics. That's patronage.
Mm-hmm.
We see that with the Irish, we see
mm-hmm.
that with Latinos. That's American politics. It's based on patronage.
Yes.
And we see that. So it has
we still see it.
It's the same game.
So we're going to discuss... At this march, we've already talked about education. We're going to talk about mass incarceration.
Second chance programs, right?
And we're also looking at healthcare.
We're going to look at second chance programs, police community partnerships,
okay.
educational equity. We have Professor Brown Dean talking about voting. Because we have a voter registration table. We'll be at the Green on Saturday.
Okay.
So people need to get registered to vote. And then we have Robin Porter talking
state
about
rep.
Specific right state rep talking about specific things she's working on in Hartford
mm-hmm.
that people can find out more information. So let's say, you know what? I have a kid in high school. I want to do educational equity. Where can I go for that? you know, I have a cousin or someone who's coming out looking for opportunities. What can I do with that? You know, I'm interested in this whole police community partnership. If the city is working on some programs, how can I get engaged? Mm-hmm. So you pick what is
relevant to you.
And that's like the civil rights movement. Everyone has a role. Mm-hmm. I'm a historian. You don't want me painting your house. You want me fixing your car. Everybody has a role in this thing. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to look at it like that. You know, mm-hmm. if you look at it that way, then there's less pressure on yourself. You work with something you're passionate about. If you're not passionate about educational equity and you're passionate about police community relations, then you do that. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? I think that's how you look at it, right? One piece at a time. So if you look at the history of the civil rights movement, people work to their strengths. For some people, this dialogue thing, that's their thing. Go in a room as a professor who works at Connecticut College. We have students who are upper middle class. I'm their first black professor. Mm-hmm. So I have mm-hmm. no problem. But for other folks, you know what? I'm more interested in going into, you know, New Hallville, rounding up these folks. Let's get engaged. That's fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
We all have a role to play. Yeah. I think we have to just understand that. Mm-hmm. And when you work from passion, you're more effective than working from, oh, that's right. me. I have to fix your car. I'm mad. I got to do house stuff. I'm angry. With stuff like this, getting on the radio, writing books, I'm excited.
You're passionate. That's where the passion is. So what do you want? We've talked about, you know, mm-hmm. we've done the dance here. But what do you want people to really know about this march? I mean, we've talked about it, but in a nutshell, what do you say to a person on the street?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So why we always march all the time. You hear that. So A, we say, okay, 100 years, okay, we know racism does not work. We always think racism in the Klan, these individual acts, mm-hmm. right? We know lynching is gone. You know, someone would say out there, well, you know, let's be honest, lynching doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. But there's still racial oppression. How is it? African Americans are twice unemployed than whites. The infant mortality rate is twice, right? So what are we going to do to change systemic racism? Mm-hmm. So I said educational equity. Equality says all students have a right to go to school, but we know the schools aren't equal. So let's change the language, equity. We know the funding situation. Mm-hmm. Greenwich because of property taxes.
Correct.
And New Haven. Well, you know, they get four. No, no. The way it's set up based on property, it's not equal. Equity says, ideal world, the federal government should subsidize to make it equal. That's a whole other conversation another time. So equity, changing the language. Mm-hmm. Racism is systemic. Black people are twice unemployed, not because black folks don't want to work. I know about your cousin. No, it's right. systemic. If we can change how we see the questions, how we answer them, that's a great start. Then what do? We have to change the language, right? We have to see from different perspectives, educational equity, right? Why there's so much mass incarceration? All the work's out there, right? It's a $1 billion industry, okay? So we have to make it. It's not that, you know, blacks have a crime gene. That's a bunch of nonsense. It's because of lack of opportunity. But that also connects to global capitalism. Race to the bottom. People want to pay less.
Say what global capitalism
right.
is.
So we said, right, global. So if you go to, I was just in Ghana in March, mm-hmm. right? So what do we see in these countries? You have the same income inequality we see in America. If you go to Ghana, Accra, there's a nice middle class with the Range Rover, going to happy hours at the nice 5-star hotel. Then on the flip side, you have folks making little to no money. Unfortunately, we see in America this same type of income divide. This is global. You see, in Europe, Western Europe, we see what you are open to immigrants coming. You wanted some cheap labor. We see that here, right? So this is a global capitalist issue. We know there's more billionaires every year. That doesn't make any sense.
But why are we more affected by global capitalism now? Because technically slavery was global capitalism. Mm-hmm. So why are we more affected now than we were, say, 100 years ago?
Because of technology and automation.
Okay.
You see, because now look at when they made the harvester machine in 1944. All those men who were sharecroppers, you're free to go. Look at Good Time. James Evans was a person thinking
right,
of that.
Right.
So the machines replace those black laborers. So globalization, automation are replacing labor, human labor, driving costs down. On the flip side, if you're a tech person or a professional person, you're on the upside of the game.
Mm-hmm.
But that's slowly closing. We see rise of poverty in the suburbs. We see income going to the top. So we see this American middle class slowly dissipating. And that's where the frustration comes. But unfortunately, for some whites, it's attacking black people. Some African-Americans, we attack ourselves. Mm-hmm. Folks don't want to work. Folks don't want to work. Folks mm-hmm. don't want to work. Okay? It's part of this global capitalism thing. That's what we are changing the discussion, changing the arguments. And that's where we have to understand that. And we don't do a good job of it because 8-12 system does not engage in that.
Mm-hmm.
They're too worried, focused on these facts. Abraham Lincoln's birthday, you know, July 4th. What does that mean? Let's get into these conversations earlier for students that have opportunity to go to college so they can have these conversations, know how to have them. And I think that's the challenge that we have in this nation.
All right. So this coming Saturday, starting from the Q House, that's 192 o'clock. Dixwell Avenue.
Correct.
You are stepping off exactly at 11 o'clock.
11 o'clock.
And this is the silent protest parade and rally. It acknowledges the silent protest from 100 years ago.
Correct.
It also acknowledges the Greater New Haven chapter of the NAACP, or branch. I got to remember the state branches, not chapters. Scott X and Dory will get me for that. it is the Greater New Haven branch of the NAACP's 100th anniversary.
Correct.
So this is how it is being acknowledged.
Correct.
So if there's any questions, how do people yes. reach out? How do people right. find out more information?
Well, you know, nowadays it's all social media. So there's a Facebook poster and out. They can contact number the NAACP's office on Whaley Avenue. Contact the office. I have to give out the number
okay.
to the office on Whaley Avenue.
Okay.
And just call the office. Have any questions? Make sure you have your walking shoes.
Yeah, have a good pair of sneakers.
Bring some water.
Yep.
You know, stay hydrated. There may be some water out, but bring somebody on the safe side. And then we should be done 12:30 because I know Sheila E's that night. So you can get your politics on in the morning and get your party on in the evening. That's how
and celebrate the NAACP's 100th anniversary.
And here's the number to the office.
Okay.
1-203-389-7275.
All right.
If you have any questions, give that a call. So that's what's going on this Saturday.
Appreciate you being here, Dr. David Canton.
Oh, this was great. Hopefully I get invited back.
You will be invited back. We have a lot to talk about. Got to get you in here with a couple of other people.
Hey, no problem.
Get you done. Mancho, thank you so much for being here patiently and waiting for everybody. I know how that is. I used to have a 13-year-old. She doesn't travel with me anymore. She's 20 now.
And we encourage the youth to come out there, too.
Yes,
the future.
Please.
You're never too young to get out there and get started. I want to share one story.
Hurry up.
When I was 14, my dad took me to see Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael at Columbia University. Of course, I didn't want to go.
Of course. Of course you did.
I want to watch TV, but young people need to come out. You're never too young to start getting engaged, getting politicized, understanding how society works and what role you can do to make it better.
And you're never too old.
That's true, too.
Either or.
Just bring your water.
And make sure you have good sneakers.
Yes.
All right. Thank you all for being here this afternoon, today, this morning. This has been the show on 103.5 FM, WNHH, newhavenindependent.org. We stream, and this has been the show. Thank you.